Toyota, the number one consumer choice on the most fuel-efficient automaker, and now during Toyota's number one for a reason event, get 0.9% APR financing on a 2010 Prius.
From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. Did I say last week that the ongoing basketball tournament should be called March Sanity? Boy, was I wrong. Ahead on Only a Game, a wrap-up of the Zany Men's Sweet 16 play, a preview of the women's regionals, and a new Frontline documentary explores how big money influences men's college hoops. Also the latest from Barry Bonds' perjury trial. Also ahead, the Harlem Globetrotters bring their winning message on the road.
You know what? We don't know how to lose. I've never lost a game since I've been on the Harlem Globetrotters. I mean, I don't even know what does that look like? What does it feel like? Does it smell?
Stay tuned.
Major funding for Only a Game comes from Oliver Wyman, an international strategy consulting firm. With 3,000 professionals worldwide, Oliver Wyman serves global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com.
This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. The racket you hear is your bracket, I fear, as favorites fall, at least some, though not all. In last night's NCAA men's basketball tournament action, Kentucky upset number one seed Ohio State 62-60, and Virginia Commonwealth slipped by Florida State 72-71. They needed an overtime to do that, and if you had Virginia Commonwealth going this far in the tournament, I would very much appreciate a postcard with your stock market picks. Kansas, another number one seed, made sure the experts wouldn't feel completely ridiculous by beating Richmond 77-57, and UNC prevailed over Marquette 81-63. Thursday night's upsets included Connecticut, a number three seed, over number two San Diego State, which paled compared to number eight Butler's dispatching of number four Wisconsin, which was overshadowed by number five Arizona's win over defending champion Duke, a number one seed, 93-77. Today's games have Arizona facing UConn and Butler playing Florida. Tomorrow we'll find Kentucky matching up with UNC and Virginia Commonwealth trying to beat the number one seed, Kansas. The regionals of the women's tournament will transpire today and tomorrow. Joining me now to comment on that competition is Michelle Smith, who's covering the tournament for ESPNW. Michelle, welcome back to Only a Game.
Happy to be here.
Let us begin today by listening to UConn coach Gino Auriemma.
I think we've got a real spoiled group of fans who just assume that we're going to win, assume that we're going to be in Philadelphia, assume we're going to the Final Four.
Michelle, UConn won their first two games by scores of 75-39 and 64-40. What's Coach Auriemma complaining about?
I think in this case, I think his frustration was that it was the last home game for Maya Moore, and they didn't have a great turnout. He was hoping for more folks to come out to honor her. But Gino sometimes can make a good point and deliver it horribly. I mean, what he's trying to say, I think, is he feels that his team and their success is being taken for granted by their fan base. But, you know, you can assume, I think, almost that UConn is going to win these games and you're going to move on to Philadelphia and perhaps to Indianapolis. And in these economic times, perhaps people are saving their money for the next trip, knowing that this one is pretty much taken care of. I mean, there's a lot of things that go into it. But yes, I think that maybe people are indeed taking for granted the success Connecticut has. And Gino, on that particular day with Maya in her last game, didn't take it very well, and he didn't express himself very well.
Of course, I would think some other coaches of women's teams might be thinking, hey, geez, if we had 6,000 people in the building, we'd be thrilled.
Of course. But when they go to Hartford or when they play at home, you know, they've had 10, 12, 13,000 people in the building. You know, somebody made a joke that they didn't think that Gino liked the fact that he got outdrawn that first weekend by Stanford, Tennessee, and Baylor. So, you know, maybe, maybe not.
In each region, the top two seeds have advanced. The same certainly cannot be said of the men's tournament. Just ask anybody in Pittsburgh. But why have the women's results run so true to form?
Well, they have, although we did lose a two seed in the Spokane regional when Xavier went down. But, I mean, the number one seeds, there's those who will tell you there are four big dogs is what the term somebody used, and everybody else, and that would be the Connecticut, Stanford, Tennessee, and Baylor foursome. And I think there are literally four dominant teams in women's basketball this year, and everybody else is hoping to get a shot at it. But really, that's the final four that people are kind of anticipating and, frankly, pretty much looking forward to. It would be a spectacular final four with those four teams.
Even some of the games that haven't featured those four dominant teams have been pretty lopsided. I got scores like 80-62, 76-57, 66-30, and so on. Only about 20% of the games have seen teams within 5 points of each other at the buzzer. Are you surprised at how lopsided some of these games have been?
I think there are more talented kids going to more schools, but in the case of this season, I'm going to say I think it has diluted the talent a little bit. It's diluted the quality of play. I think that there are more good players choosing different schools to go to. But again, outside of those top four teams, this has not been the most competitive year. People generally think that there is a big drop-off, in even within the top 25 of the teams that you're getting. So no, I'm not terribly surprised to see this.
Wisconsin-Green Bay has never been this deep in the tournament before. The chalk suggests that Brittany Griner and Baylor will put an end to their ride tomorrow. I assume you think that's how it'll go.
You assume correctly that I assume, yes. They're a great mid-major program. They had a terrific year. They've got a coach who, frankly, may be up for the Wisconsin opening in the Big Ten. But I think that, yes, Baylor is clearly the better team there.
Today in Sweet 16 action, Louisville will meet Gonzaga. Louisville's freshman point guard, Shoni Schimmel, who grew up on the Umatilla Indian Reservation in Oregon, sometimes makes Larry Bird-type behind-the-back passes, whether or not her teammates are expecting them. I guess her coach, Jeff Walls, has to just hope the rest of his players do expect them tonight.
She's a great player, and he's been apparently very patient with her this year and said she's a freshman, she's going to make mistakes, she's learning. Her family, they were on the reservation. Her mother took a job coaching at a high school in Portland for her senior year, moved their entire family. I think there's 7 or 8 kids in that family, moved them all to Portland, and Shoni played on that team in Portland, and they came off the reservation to do that. You know, Shoni's sort of carrying the banner for the entire family. There's a lot been written about it, but it's a pretty extraordinary story.
Connecticut has lost only one game this season. They would seem to be the class of the left side of the brackets, even though Tennessee has only lost twice. But the right side seems to me a little harder to handicap. What about for you?
Stanford beat Connecticut. Connecticut beat Baylor. Baylor beat Tennessee. Tennessee beat Stanford. I mean, if you want to put four teams in a Final Four and try and figure out what's going to happen, you could not make it more interesting, I think, than this. And Tennessee's pretty good. And, you know, Connecticut has the one loss, but Tennessee's played pretty darn well all year long. I think this is setting up to be a really, really interesting end of the season.
All right. I feel a little bit silly asking the founder and editor of Left Coast Hoops which team wins this tournament. It's in the charter of your website that you have to say Stanford, right?
Well, I don't have to, but I actually think it could be, I'm going to say Stanford or Baylor. I think Connecticut's depth issues, when they get really far into the tournament, and I mean far, I mean perhaps all the way to the title game, may end up being costly. I don't think as much as Stephanie Dolson has come around in the post, I don't think that that's their strength. There's no Tina Charles there to balance out Maya Moore. And there does seem to be some statistical evidence that Maya has carried the load for them all year, and she might be getting a little tired. I'm not sure Connecticut's going to win it this year. I think they'll win the semi if they end up playing Tennessee, and I think it would be Baylor or Stanford beating them in the championship.
Michelle Smith is covering the tournament for ESPNW, and we try to find her under the basket each time we visit the land of women's college basketball. Thanks, Michelle.
Thank you.
This week, spectators at the perjury trial of Barry Bonds in San Francisco were told by experts that steroids can alter the user's appearance. They heard the defendant repeat that he'd been told the Clear, a steroid which he has acknowledged that he used unknowingly, was just flaxseed oil. According to Ben McGrath, whose account of the Bonds saga appears in the current New Yorker magazine, this contention has been popular among ballplayers about whom doubts having to do with chemistry have been raised.
Almost all these guys talk about, some way or another, the fact that they were taking arthritic balm or flaxseed oil, which we now believe designer steroids that were not yet known about, which wouldn't show up on drug tests. So, you know, that's the wiggle room that someone like Barry Bonds is using in a trial like this, which is that, hey, you know, my man told me it was arthritic balm.
During a break in the testimony, Robert Powell, a friend of trainer Greg Anderson, who allegedly told Bonds the clear was flaxseed oil, attempted to put the trial in context.
8 years of money, and there's homeless around. I mean, you know, and then they're talking about a deficit. You know, it's unreal. I think the federal government should be cleaning their own backyard before they start stepping into somebody else.
Among the arguments for the government's tenacity in pursuing Barry Bonds are that lying to a grand jury is a serious offense that should not be ignored, no matter how rich or accomplished the alleged perjurer, and that prosecution is necessary to the reclamation of baseball's integrity, which is critical to the game's popularity. But between sessions at the MIT Sloan Sports Analytics Conference in Boston earlier this month, Rob Nyer, national baseball editor for SB Nation, maintained that baseball fans are hard to discourage.
Basically every winter for the last, I don't know how many winters, there's been a big steroid story in the offseason. And I get the same questions every time. What are the fans going to think about this? How is this going to impact attendance? Is this going to kill baseball? Well, almost every year attendance goes up and revenues go up. Fans don't care.
Opinion is divided about the outcome of the Bonds trial, which is expected to last at least another week. Ben McGrath's research leads him to think Bonds, the all-time bases-on-balls leader, shouldn't expect to walk.
I think there's probably a decent chance that he might get convicted on one count or something. The question is, what will that prove? He's not really probably going to go to prison, and if he does, he'll go to prison for a month or two. I mean, everyone thus far who's been charged with what Bonds has been charged with, which is perjury, has just got home confinement, house arrest.
Baseball fans and others who've already had their fill of stories about players who may have used steroids and lied about same are in for a long summer. A little before the All-Star break, Roger Clemens will go on trial. Rob Nyer is among those who see similarities between the two former All-Stars.
Well, Roger Clemens and Barry Bonds are both distinctly unlikable people for different reasons, but basically neither of them ever grew up. They're essentially arrested adolescents. And that doesn't go over very well, especially when you're public about it. You know, not on purpose, that's just the way they are.
The quality Nyer ascribes to the defendants may or may not influence a jury. Attorneys for Bonds may be counting on the jury seeing him as a victim of overzealous prosecutors with limitless funds and all the time in the world to harass their client. According to Ben McGrath, lawyers representing Roger Clemens would have more difficulty making that case.
Roger Clemens actually volunteered to go before Congress. He volunteered to stand before television cameras and declare to everyone who was willing to listen that he didn't do any of these things. That makes it a little bit harder for him to get the jury's sympathy as someone who's the victim of a kind of prosecution gone awry.
The Bonds trial will resume on Monday in San Francisco. The trial of Roger Clemens is scheduled to begin on July 6th in Washington, D.C. It's 19 minutes past the hour. One might assume that the very qualities that enable an athlete to thrive as a sumo wrestler would hinder him were he to run a marathon, and one would be right. When sumo wrestler Kelly Knighting ran in Sunday's event, he became the heaviest man ever to compete in a marathon. Although compete might not be quite the right term, Mr. Knighting took 9 hours, 48 minutes, and 52 seconds to finish the race. He walked on the sidewalk and stopped for traffic signals since he had lagged behind the 13-minute-per-mile pace used for calculating street reopenings. The sumo wrestler reported afterward that he had lost track of where he was after mile 10 because he felt delirious. No surprise there for a marathoner who weighs 400 pounds. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, the Harlem Globetrotters assume temporary professorships at Harvard University. But first, on Tuesday evening, as bracketologists all over the country prepare to watch the closing rounds of the men's NCAA basketball tournament, the PBS program Frontline will air an examination of the big business of college basketball titled Money and March Madness. Joining me now from the University of California at Berkeley is Lowell Bergman. He is the reporter for that documentary. Lowell, welcome to Only a Game.
Nice to be here.
The documentary establishes that the money generated by televising college basketball in March funds not only that sport, but lots of other college sports as well, and that the most prominent college coaches make millions of dollars in salary and shoe company money. But none of this is entirely new information. Why a documentary about the subject in 2011?
Because in 2011, there is a class action lawsuit pending in federal court in Northern California, which most legal observers say, it's already actually part of it been appealed to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. And the issue is, are the college athletes, particularly the basketball and football players and their revenue sports, really employees and not just simply students? And don't they deserve a piece of this action?
We're going to get to some of the particulars of that lawsuit in a minute. But first, I want to play a bit of the documentary in which Mark Emmert, the president of the NCAA, is defending his organization's administration of what he calls amateur athletics in general and college basketball in particular.
We provide them with remarkable opportunities to get an education at the finest universities on earth, that's American universities and colleges, to gain access to the best coaches and the best trainers to develop their skills and abilities. So if they have the potential, that small proportion, to go on and play in professional sports, we're helping them develop those skills and they can go do it. If they choose to not go on, or if they don't have those skills or abilities, then they get to go on in life and be successful as a young man or a young woman.
Is President Emmert wrong?
Not in if you accept all of his assumptions, he's not wrong. If you leave out the reality of where these players primarily are coming from, what their particular socioeconomic situation is, and the realities of the academic performance, particularly we're talking here about that small group of Division I revenue sports like football and men's basketball, then they don't usually get that opportunity. Graduation rates in 17 of the teams that are in March Madness this year are below 50% for the team as a whole, and usually a fraction of that for the African-American players who make up those teams. And there's one team, University of Arizona, has a 20% graduation rate. Hmm. Many of the players simply, as we all know, want to get to the NBA, and they've got to do basically 2 years out of high school before they can get there.
And, of course, most of them don't get to the NBA. And I wonder, therefore, how President Emmert can say what he says with a straight face. I mean, he knows the statistics.
The United States has a unique system of, quote, amateur collegiate sports. No other country in the world organizes its sports competitions this way. We know we're very familiar with, let's say, baseball and farm teams. We don't have that in football or basketball, especially higher up in those more almost semi-pro divisions, because this is the way it developed over the last 100 years. But no one else does business this way, and no one in any other country would say this is done for the academic benefit of the players.
You interviewed Ed O'Bannon, who played for UCLA more than 15 years ago and led that team to a national title. The NCAA has been making money by selling Mr. O'Bannon's image to various people, including a company that put a character based on him in a video game, and Mr. O'Bannon and others are suing the NCAA to prevent what they call exploitation. What is the current status of that suit?
The suit is active in the Northern District of California in federal court. It has survived all motions to dismiss. One aspect of it, which has to do with the video game maker EA Sports, Electronic Arts, saying in their defense that they were only using his interpreted image and therefore they have a First Amendment right to use it without paying him, that is now up in the appellate courts. But it's moving towards discovery while that's happening. I should point out that appeal, almost all major media organizations in the United States joined on the side of EA Sports. This is becoming a major battle also for the entertainment and broadcast industries.
Lowell, people love March Madness, and as you have demonstrated, the tournament generates a lot of money. In those two respects, it's a magnificent success. What's the likelihood that the circumstance will change?
Well, I think in this case, it will be a question of how it fares legally. You know, in 1984, the Supreme Court ruled so the NCAA could not control football and basketball in the regular season. This is the last part of the game that they still control completely, other than making the rules. And I think the other side of it is that when you look at the rules of the NCAA, this 440-page manual, it demonstrates, I think, that there's a real crisis here in terms of what do we really mean by amateur, and are we keeping certain people in a certain stricture or image that simply isn't fair? That's the question that's been raised. And by the way, what's news here in some ways is that Joakim Noah, who plays in the pros, is one of the first players ever to speak out. Players are afraid, generally speaking, to talk about this in any kind of critical fashion. We found that doing interviews across the country.
Well, what explains that reluctance?
The way it was described to us was that when they're in college, they talk at study hall, they talk over the training table, they don't talk even to their own coaches usually about issues like this because they do want to make the team, they do want to make it to the NBA, and this is their ticket. In some cases, people that we talked with were somewhat embarrassed by the fact that they didn't make it in the NBA, that they were cut. On the other hand, if you look at the list of plaintiffs and many more, we could send anybody to more people that we talk to, not just the plaintiffs, in football and basketball. Later on, as they grow, as they live life, you can actually get people to talk and step forward, like Oscar Robertson.
In the course of your investigation, did you encounter anybody who proposed an alternative to the current model that might satisfy the players, the coaches, and the NCAA?
Well, I think in the discussions with the plaintiffs and with others, law experts in law and economics, the discussion is why is it that if the universities and the NCAA are going to make money off the images of these players after they leave college, there should be some kind of trust fund for them, for the residuals from it. For example, if they do make it to the NBA and their image is used by EA Sports, they get paid. It's only if they didn't make money, they don't get paid.
Mm-hmm.
And so the idea is to set up some fund possibly to help them finish college because many people just go through on their way to playing pro. And we need also a study, people talk about, of what the consequences are for the athletes in general.
Lowell Bergman is the reporter for Frontline's Money and March Madness. The program will air on PBS stations on Tuesday night. Lowell, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you for having me.
On Monday afternoon at Harvard University's Malkin Athletic Center, everybody was feeling fine. That was because the guy asking was one of the Harlem Globetrotters, and most of the rest of the people in the building were students at the nearby Martin Luther King Elementary and Middle School. The kids couldn't wait to see the Globetrotters perform their sleight of hand and foot and head with the basketball. But first, there were some more serious matters to consider.
Healthy mind and body. Everybody say healthy mind and body.
For the past 7 years, various and numerous manifestations of the Globetrotters have had a mission beyond showmanship. They've brought the children a program the Globies call Cheer. The letters in that word stand for character, healthy mind and body, effort, enthusiasm, and responsibility. On Monday, the Globies picked 4 children and 1 teacher to step down out of the bleacher and define those words, after which everybody clapped and the 4 lucky children and their teacher formed an amateur version of the Globetrotters' famous magic circle. The magic circle as performed by the pros was as impressive as it has been for the past 85 years, and the kids enjoyed it much as their parents and grandparents had enjoyed it when Meadowlark Lemon and Goose Tatum were still clowning, though I can't remember either of them doing backwards handsprings.
Yes, I really liked it, and I like them because that flip, I like it.
That's Destiny, who's in the first grade. Her mom, Lydia Wharton, probably enjoyed the flip too, though she also noted the benefits of the cheer program.
It was an educational thing for the kids. I think that, you know, what they learn, hopefully it'll help them, you know, be more into going to school and have that education and look forward to it.
Annalise Aminoff was another of the youngsters with a parent in tow on Monday. She's a first grader, and she provided evidence that for a 7-year-old, even the oldest basketball trick in the book can seem new.
Yeah, I really, really want to spin a basketball on my finger.
What do you think, Dad? You going to be ready to help her learn that?
I'm not sure that's my skill set, but I'll try.
Responsibility, thy name is helping your daughter learn to spin a basketball on her finger, or something like that. As the kids gathered around the Globetrotters to get autographs at the end of the program, Anthony Blakes, a.k.a. Buckets, explained why he and his teammates focused on character, the first concern of the cheer program.
You can be the most talented, the most popular, the smartest kid in class, but without character, none of that matters. So that's what this is all about, trying to make sure that these kids know that character can take them a long way in life.
Buckets has been a Globetrotter for 9 years, during the last 7 of which he has been an ambassador for cheer, and he has no doubt that it's working.
When you look at these kids, you can see them engaged in what we're saying and that it's something simple to remember for them as well. And not only that, you know, they get to have a little fun at the same time, so it's not just us coming in with a speech about character. We also involve the kids by letting them do a little ball handling, as well as pulling out a teacher. You know, sometimes the kids need to see the teachers having fun.
And sometimes they have to see the teachers trying to dance, which puts the teachers in exactly the spot the kids would like to see them.
Exactly. They got to know that their teachers are human beings and vulnerable, too, and they're not spooky. You can go talk to them anytime you want to. So we pull a teacher out and get them to dance and do some tricks with the basketball, and that's what it's all about. We're all human beings here. We just want to be the best human beings we can possibly be each and every day.
The Globetrotters proudly consider themselves role models, but anybody familiar with the history of this team, which travels with a personal patsy squad, the Washington Generals, knows the Trotters are never defeated. So I asked Buckets Blakes how he and his teammates could teach children what it means to lose with grace.
You know what? We don't know how to lose. I've never lost a game since I've been on the Harlem Globetrotters.
This astonishes me.
You know, this is my 9th season, and you know, I've lost in college. I lost on other professional teams. But going 9 years without a loss, I mean, I don't even know what does that look like? What does it feel like? Does it smell?
One of the other Globetrotters, Nate Big Easy Lofton, overheard that last business, and when he'd completed the autograph he was in the process of signing, he offered some of his thoughts about the unimaginable losing.
Well, the Globetrotters are winners. But the last time we lost was in 1971. And I was born in 1981, so I had nothing to do with that.
So the cheer program does not talk about accepting defeat with equanimity. But Buckets and Big Easy and the rest of the Trotters at Harvard on Monday made a good case for the rest of the components of cheer, and they made lots of young friends as well.
We sign autographs for 30 minutes after every game, and then these kids will walk up to you after the game asking for an autograph and like, hey, you came to my school last year and you talked about cheer. So, you know, that gives you the chills, you know, like you actually got through. And our whole point is, if we've only touched, you know, 5 or 6 children out of these 150, 200 kids, we've done our job for the day, because those 5 or 6 children will be our messengers for the rest of the time when we're not around.
Excuse me, can I get an autograph? Can I get a shot?
Members of the Harlem Globetrotters will next be delighting and inspiring children of all ages in Asheville, North Carolina, Macon, Georgia, Bangor, Maine, Montreal, and Minneapolis. It's one thing to hear about the Globetrotters' magic circle, and I certainly hope you've enjoyed that thing, though researching the story was just agonizing. Anyway, if you'd like to see a video of the circle in action, visit our website, onlyagame.org. No website made has got a shade on it, as has been said of sweet Georgia Brown herself. You're listening to Only a Game. What the Harlem Globetrotters do is work. They travel constantly. Their bus looks comfortable, and the outside features great big grinning players in bright primary colors, but it's still a bus. What is magical to their audiences must be hard-earned routine to them. You do not learn to spin a basketball on your finger or balance it on your head or roll it from one shoulder to the other without hundreds of hours of practice. It is the work that makes these tricks seem effortless. But watching the Globies is pure fun. Being in their presence is a delight that reminds everybody in the building of something that we too often forget. Our games can be a joyful diversion. The show the Globetrotters put on is like that night at the Olympics after the skating competition has ended, when the athletes take to the ice in an exhibition of their skills and their youth and perhaps their relief that this time, if they catch an edge and tumble, nobody will deduct anything. In part because of what our games have become, and in part because of the nature of the coverage of sports these days, a lot of the stories that used to be about exceptional feats and records challenged and broken are about drugs, injuries, lockouts, and louts. The owner who threatens to move if some city doesn't build him a new stadium, never mind that the city's laying off workers. The player who demands a new contract because his agent has put a hand on his shoulder and whispered something about another player's money. As the Globetrotter known as Buckets told me, we just want to be the best human beings we can be, each and every day. That's a challenging and complicated goal, but surely somewhere on the list of requirements to achieve it are the willingness to laugh and the ability to inspire laughter, the capacity to delight, and an openness to the delight others can inspire. The Globetrotters are not alone in providing fans with those qualities and opportunities. The long run that ends in a dive as the ball disappears into the center fielder's glove in the shadow of the wall. The pinpoint, impossibly patient passing of a quartet of soccer players. These images, likewise, temporarily erase the distinction between work and play. Sometimes my work puts me in the way of that happy circumstance, and it feels like play. May each of you, from time to time, fall into that same good fortune. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced, Harvard University, whose summer school has courses for high school, college, and adults to earn academic credit and experience campus life, summer.harvard.edu, and Oliver Wyman, an international strategy consulting firm. With 3,000 professionals worldwide, Oliver Wyman serves global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com. This is NPR.
Nobody can be two places at once. Martin Williams, a flanker on the Newport Gwent Dragons rugby team in Wales, wishes it were otherwise. The Newport Gwent Dragons have a big game on April 29th, the same day upon which Prince William will wed Kate Middleton. That wouldn't be a problem, except that Mr. Williams and his wife have been invited to the wedding. I've been fortunate to meet Prince William a few times, Mr. Williams said recently, but I was as shocked as anybody else when I got the invite. Mrs. Williams, also shocked, was delighted, which brings us to the dilemma. I still don't know if the coach will let me go, Mr. Williams said, but my wife has bought her hat. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, two editors of the new boxing anthology At the Fights duke it out. Not really, they just talk with each other and with me. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for our look at the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hey, Bill.
Defending NCAA champion Duke is defending no more. The Blue Devils were knocked out of the tournament on Thursday night by Arizona. Mike Krzyzewski has never led Duke to a Sweet 16 victory in the West region, so good thing he has no interest in coaching in the NBA, right?
Right, but he's now a little bit stuck in the same problem every college basketball coach has, which is that he's got a one-and-done syndrome going there now. Kyrie Irving's probably going to leave for the NBA if he has a brain in his head. But the game the other night against Arizona, you saw a Duke team fall apart like you have not seen a Duke team fall apart since UNLV ran them off the floor in the national championship game in 1990. Derek Williams had the greatest half of scoring that anyone's ever had in the tournament and then scored 2 points in the second half when Arizona came back and just flattened them.
San Diego State is also out. They lost to UConn on Thursday night. We profiled the number 2 seed earlier this season. So was this the only a game curse at work, or was it just time for the team which had never before won a game in the Division I NCAA tournament to bow out?
No, they got lit up by Kemba Walker and a very enthusiastic young UConn team. And frankly, San Diego State played that game like the inexperienced and volatile and immature team rather than Connecticut, which is relying on a lot of very young players.
Meanwhile, Gino Auriemma, the coach of the University of Connecticut women's team, was waxing sarcastic this week, as we heard a little earlier in the program. He was upset because a tournament game at UConn did not fill the house. What do you think of Coach Auriemma's idea for getting more fans into the seats?
Apparently he wants a little bit of what the NBA calls game presentation. Free parking, free giveaways, firing T-shirts out of cannons.
And fans get the opportunity to coach.
You have a guest coach every quarter. I wonder if Jim Calhoun would volunteer, because that would really
He's
be
right
cool.
He's right down the hall.
That would really be cool. Yeah, but you have to go through Checkpoint Charlie to get there. No, I think Gino makes an interesting point. I mean, it is entirely possible that the UConn women have been too good for their fan base. And maybe what they need is a couple of years we're not beating everybody by 29 points.
Meanwhile, Ralph Nader has decided
another Connecticut
that
native.
The NCAA tournament is the perfect time to combat professionalism in college sports. What do you think of Mr. Nader's suggestion that the best way to stop universities from taking advantage of college athletes is to do away with athletic scholarship?
Well, I mean, it's an interesting proposal, although since I am not in favor of deprofessionalizing college athletes, but rather professionalizing college athletics, I think we're on opposite sides of the same divide.
Recognize their pros, pay them, and get on with
get
it.
Get on with it. Move on with your life.
Meanwhile, if you're the mayor of Sacramento and you're trying to stop your city's NBA team from being moved to Anaheim, it's got to be a little disheartening to see the move being described as, quote, more inevitable by the hour on the NBA's own website. What? Is two professional basketball teams in L.A. not enough for Southern California?
Except Sacramento's not a major league city. It simply isn't. It was a fluke that they got that they wound up there in the first place. And they've been extraordinarily lucky to maintain that franchise as long as they have. And it's time for it to move.
In NHL news, Matt Cook of the Pittsburgh Penguins was suspended this week for the remainder of the regular season and the first round of the playoffs for elbowing Rangers defenseman Ryan McDonagh in the head. Pens owner Mario Lemieux and GM Ray Shiro have both come out in support of that lengthy suspension. Did that surprise you?
No, but it does raise the question why they didn't suspend this goon themselves when they had the power.
Before he had the opportunity
long
to
before,
elbow somebody else
Long
in the
before
head.
He had a chance to hurt somebody else after he practically ended Mark Savard's career last year. I find Mario and Ray Shiro extraordinarily disingenuous in their current disapproval of Matt Cook.
When the Montreal Canadiens and Boston Bruins met for the first time since Canadiens forward Max Pacioretty was hit by Bruins' Adeno Chara, many expected fireworks. There were fireworks. There were 7 goals by one team and none by the other. But what do you think of the headline in the Montreal Gazette?
What, Canadiens butt kicked in Boston? I think somebody translated it badly from the French. I do not believe butt kick is what you call in your language a verb.
Charlie, it's almost time for baseball that counts. The regular season starts on Thursday.
Oh, boy!
I know it's risky to draw any conclusions from spring training games, but on the other hand, the defending champion San Francisco Giants have won about twice as often as they have lost this spring, and the Pittsburgh Pirates have lost an awful lot more than they have won, so meaningless, you decide.
Well, those are two things you can count on. San Francisco will be good this year, and Pittsburgh will be bad. Other than that, you know, it really is now about conditioning and tinkering and settling your pitching rotation and stuff like that. So no, I would draw no conclusions from spring training games.
Remember those stories about how the Mets had money troubles? I think they took another $12 million hit this week. Have I done the math correctly?
They released Oliver Perez, and they're just going to eat the $12 million left on his idiotic $36 million 3-year contract. And he's been trying to make the team as a reliever while he's been in New York. You know, you can't blame everything on Bernie Madoff, folks, and this is just bad management.
At least one fan thinks that he has found a way to get the NFL playing again. Cleveland businessman Ken Lancey has sued the NFL and its 32 teams. He says the lockout violates his private seat license contract. What are the chances Commissioner Goodell says, oh, my bad, and settles right away?
He's going to get a hearing on this. Number one, he's a millionaire, so he's got enough of what we call in business schools FU money to hire really good lawyers and pursue this for a while. And number two, I'm not entirely sure he doesn't have a case. Personal seat licenses are a contract. They're kind of a, you know, a funky business device that were invented to essentially pay for egregiously overpriced stadiums. I'm going to follow this because this guy actually seems to know what he's talking about.
Meanwhile, the first pro athlete to model jockey underwear since 1980 will be Tim Tebow. So, you think he'll find a way to feature Bible verses on his Stay Cool briefs?
Doing the show for going on 20 years, first question I ever got that completely, completely baffled me.
Okay, Charlie, we know you're the only member of the Only Game staff to have actually watched a World Cup soccer in Qatar. So, as the expert, what do you think about the country's plans to keep stadiums cool during the 2022 World Cup?
Apparently, they've bought their own weather. They're going to have not only air-conditioned open-air stadiums, they're going to have an artificial cloud to hover above the stadium.
Excellent.
And provide shade. Of course, Los Angeles and various Midwestern industrial cities have been providing their residents with artificial clouds for years. But we call it smog.
And finally, Charlie, Russia's opportunity to host the Olympics comes around a little sooner. That'd be in 2014. Any evidence that that country's leader is looking forward to the Games?
He's already having fun, isn't he? Vladimir Putin, your fun-loving former KGB thug, has declared an injured snow leopard as the official mascot and has apparently gone to frolic with the injured snow leopard, which is probably sitting there wishing it wasn't so injured. But snow leopards are, without question, my favorite animals in all the world. There's several in a zoo near Boston. I go up and look at them twice a year just to watch them move. I'm thrilled to death it's a mascot. I'm glad it's saved. And if 15 minutes with Putin is the price we have to pay for one more snow leopard in the world, I say go ahead.
Charlie Pierce is the author of Idiot America and various other books. He joins me each week at this time on Only a Game as well. Thank you, Charlie.
Today's reading is from the Book of Briefs.
From Russia with love, I fly to you. Much wiser since my goodbye to you. I've traveled the world to learn.
Boxing is not without its moral ambiguities. So writes George Kimball in his introduction to a new book titled At the Fights, American Writers on Boxing. Perhaps those moral ambiguities are in part responsible for boxing having generated some of the most worthy writing connected to a sport. George Kimball and his co-editor John Shulian have collected a lot of that worthy writing in At the Fights, and they join me now, John Shulian from KPCC in Pasadena. John, welcome back to Only a Game.
Thank you, Bill. It's good to be here.
And George Kimball is on the line. George, thank you for joining us despite the fact that you're having problems with your voice.
Hi, Bill. How are you doing?
Okay, thank you. Let's start at the top, or at least what I consider the top. George, I assume that you and John began the process of collecting these stories by saying something like, okay, W.C. Hines on Bummy Davis, John Lardner on Stanley Ketchel, and A.J. Liebling on Jack Kearns. Now, who else? Am I right?
Well, you're close. This thing was like a jigsaw puzzle. You know, there are certain historical things that need to be covered. So you didn't want to end up with, for instance, four pieces on Sonny Liston and none on Sugar Ray Robinson.
And I think one of our other guiding principles was we wanted pieces that emphasized the humanity in boxing and the great people and the great characters. There's really no other sport like it. It's full of fighters who've been in and out of jail and promoters who should be in jail for life and cut men and trainers, and they're all so beautiful. It seems odd to say that there's more honesty in boxing than there is in any other sport when you think of all the flim-flamming that gets done, but there really is more honesty in boxing. If you ask a fighter about how he wound up in jail, most likely he's going to tell you. And once you get them in the ring, that, of course, is the ultimate truth of boxing.
One of the features of this collection is the variety apparent in the selection. Some of the stories are about famous fighters in famous fights, Ali Frazier, Liston Patterson, Lewis Schmeling, But some of the stories are about boxers most people will not know, and John, your essay titled Nowhere to Run presents one of the latter. Tell us a little bit about what led you to write about Johnny Bratton.
Well, he was sort of ghosting his way through Chicago. He had been a welterweight champion in the 50s. He was known as Honey Boy. And I used to talk a lot with Ben Bentley, who was a great old fight guy and a PR man in Chicago. And he kept telling me about how Johnny Bratton was bumming money on the streets. And then I heard that Bratton was sleeping in an old hotel on the south side of Chicago, a place that had once been quite regal. American League teams had stayed there in the 30s, 40s, and 50s, and now was really on hard times. I went to the hotel, couldn't find him at the hotel, and then Bentley took me up to Rush Street one day and met him, and that was where Bratton was hustling money.
George, in the essay you wrote about the 1987 fight between Marvin Hagler and Ray Leonard, you include a passage that reads, "You think you remember Goody Petronelli in the corner repeatedly dispatching advice to Hagler, rough him up inside, but it dawns on you later that you couldn't possibly have heard that at ringside. Hagler's corner was clear across the ring, so the memory is a faulty one." Did you find you were at all reluctant to acknowledge that the memory was a faulty one?
No, I think, in honesty, what must have happened is that I had watched the tape of the fight so many times that I've sort of conflated it in my mind that I had actually heard it. It was really much later that I came to reflect on that and say, I couldn't have heard that. That piece, of course, was written for a magazine a couple of years after the fight. In sitting there and reconstructing what I remembered, I found myself remembering things that I couldn't have remembered.
John, you begin your introduction to At the Fights with the assertion that boxing, quote, is the best friend a writer ever had. How so?
It's almost like writing fiction. And certainly you're being fed fiction and a lot of times when, a promoter is telling you this guy's going to be the next great heavyweight. You know, we're still waiting for that heavyweight, by the way. You have the mano a mano of the fight itself, but you have the greed and the backstage manipulations, and you have the women and the flash and the dash and all the glamour and clutter and everything. And certainly, George and I have both covered a lot of sports events, the World Series, Super Bowl, Masters, Final Four, on and on like that. There's nothing that matches a big fight for pure electricity.
There's also the element of danger. You know, a guy who blows a 5-shot lead in the Masters isn't going to wind up in a coma in the hospital.
Yeah, George and I have both seen guys really hurt badly, and that always does hang over the thing. I remember a great quote from Davey Moore, who was mortally injured in a fight, and his last words to Angelo Dundee, who trained the other fighter, was, "Angie, you're going to give me a rematch, ain't you?"
That's one of the many great lines in the book, and another that I'll remember for a long time comes from the title of Bill Nack's essay. The line refers not only to Joe Frazier's loss to Muhammad Ali in 1974 when Frazier's trainer wouldn't let him leave the corner for the 15th round, but to Frazier's long-standing hatred of Ali for viciously taunting and mocking him over the years. So the fight's over, Joe.
Oh, boy, Bill Nack, yeah. That's
a wonderful piece, by the way. I mean, it's very poignant. Look, it's this bitterness that Joe Frazier retains after all these years and three fights against one another that cemented their respective reputations. And here, Joe's still carrying around this chip.
Yeah. The really interesting thing is that they destroyed each other, and by doing so, they gained immortality.
Boxing moves some writers to understatement. Here's Carlo Rotella's presentation of Joe Frazier at a fight. He politely asked the fellow next to him what town he was in. By way of contrast, Norman Mailer writes this, describing a moment during Ali, Foreman, and Zaire. Ali proceeded to hit Foreman with a combination rare as plutonium. John, when the subject is boxing and understatement squares off against overstatement, who wins?
Think of the spare writing of Bill Hines describing Bummy Davis. Tending bar, guys walk in to rob the joint. They all pull guns. And Bill Hines describes this so beautifully and so simply. And then you read Mark Cram's piece about the thrill in Manila, which is a classic. You know, that steps very close to being purple. It's beautiful.
Purple, of course, for those of our listeners who may not be familiar with the term, means somewhat over the top. Is that a fair characterization?
Very definitely, in the case of Mr. Cram, yes.
John Shulian and George Kimball are the co-editors of At the Fights, American Writers on Boxing, published by the Library of America. John Shulian joined me from KPCC in Pasadena. John, thank you very much for speaking with me.
It was my pleasure, Bill.
And George Kimball, it was good to talk to you again. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Bill.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Prabhu. Our technical director is John Ferrati. Our intern is Mark Filippino. Special thanks this week to Allison Shutterbug Littlefield and to Jesse Costa. Thanks also to Jim Richards at UC Berkeley and to Tony Federico at KPCC in Pasadena. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To view our magical Harlem Globetrotters video, subscribe to the Only a Game podcast, listen to archived shows and stories, and learn more about our weekly music selections, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Only a Game Radio. Our final word comes from 7-year-old Annalise Aminoff, who attended a Harlem Globetrotters event this week. I asked her if she liked basketball.
No, but I do like soccer.
Delightful laughs, intelligent laughs. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support comes from Mini, featuring the 37-mile-per-gallon Mini Cooper with go-kart handling. Learn more at miniusa.com/info. The Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, committed to helping Americans lead healthier lives and get the care they need, on the web at rwjf.org. And the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, making grants to solve social and environmental problems at home and around the world, on the web at hewlett.org. This is NPR.